just try out different recipes. And it was like the heat of summer. There was like condensation on the wall and my cat was running around. It was the most hectic, insane experience.
Welcome to the Hospitality Podcast.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Come on, man.
I just need a...
This the lamb.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Presented by Arthur Gomez.
God damn, I just spent $8,000 on some f***ing wine.
And Quentin Wind.
What are you?
An idiot sandwich.
So pour yourself a glass, because we're diving into the world of restaurants, kitchen, and bar. The Hospitality Podcast.
Hey, welcome back, guys.
Hey, guys.
We're back again.
Yes, another episode with another chef, actually, today.
Yeah, a new chef, Anna Sogard, the head chef at Bistro Freddy.
Yeah, and she'll be telling us about her journey, how she became a chef, and also, most amazingly, is the charity she
the
created.
Super Club.
Exactly. So, guys, don't forget to give us a little review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to go up the ranks. And I think, without further ado, grab yourself a little seat.
And we'll start the podcast now.
Exactly. Enjoy. Welcome, Hannah.
Welcome, Anna.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about your journey, where you've worked before, where you're working now, and also your future, because you've got some bits of announcements to do.
New exciting project.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's going to be exciting. So what made you go into hospitality, and were you always in hospitality?
So I have not always been in hospitality. I started by studying communications in the States. I kind of didn't really know what route to take. I went to high school in America, and you kind of have to go the route of choosing very young what you want to do. So I chose to study communications pretty much because I thought it might be easy. I had no idea what I wanted to study. Started to study that and didn't really have a passion for it. And I started working in restaurants, doing front of house. Just really loved the vibe and really loved the kind of atmosphere, and really just felt at home because it was so fast paced. And I feel like I need to constantly be kind of in motion and constantly be doing 1,000 things at a time. So
you're a hyperactive person.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. But yeah, and then I just really loved it. And then something kind of drew me into the kitchen rather than the floor. And I decided to go to cooking school. So I grew up in Copenhagen, and they have an amazing culinary program there, which I never really thought growing up in Copenhagen that would be where the place to go, because the food scene in Copenhagen is very new.
Okay.
It's not, you know, like Paris or New York. It's not a city that has always been known for food. So when I was growing up, people didn't really go out to eat. There wasn't that many places to go.
It's like London back in the 80s, basically.
yeah, very much like that. And essentially, in Copenhagen, people and chefs talk a lot about the Noma effect in Copenhagen. Yeah. So basically, you know, Noma happened and they created this whole movement of new Nordic food, and that kind of drew a lot of amazing talent from around the world in, and then they left and opened their own places. And so that's kind of what kickstarted this kind of culinary movement in Copenhagen, and now it's become this food capital.
I feel like the culinary part of it has grew up with also the Nordic design as well.
Yeah.
I feel like both really merge together.
They go hand in hand. Yeah. Well, I mean, with any kind of, I mean, a restaurant is so much more than just the food. A restaurant is about the atmosphere and the wine and the service and everything. And so, of course, like with New Nordic came that kind of minimalist, beautiful kind of Nordic design as well. So decided that was the perfect place to study. And even then there was, you know, it was, the cooking scene was very, very small compared to what it is now. But I moved back, went to cooking school, and in Copenhagen it takes 4 years and you do kind of your foundation course and you learn your basic skills, and then you go out and you just find a job as an apprentice and you just work your way up the ranks and work your way through the sections. And it's a very kind of thorough education as a chef. Yeah. So it was a really good foundation for me to kind of to learn there. And my background was more in like kind of Nordic food. So it was very niche. Okay. It was very, you know, because the Nordic climate is so, it's so unique in that it's this long winter and a very, very short, intense summer. So not a lot of things grow throughout the year. We do a lot of like fermenting, pickling, curing, things like that.
Preserved food,
yeah, exactly. And so that was a big part of kind of the of the food style and the cooking, I think that's also kind of translated into a lot of other countries' cookings as well. It's kind of become something that's become quite popular in all over, really, because it makes sense to take the best of something in the height of the season and just preserve it and manipulate it to get the most out of it throughout the year. So cooking school, I would have been about 23.
23, okay.
I think I was I would have been 26, 27 when I finished.
Okay.
So in Copenhagen, that's quite old to be a newly trained chef. It's a very young cooking scene. Considered an older kind of student.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
most of the head chefs I worked for back then were under 30.
Really? Already a chef at 30? Wow.
Yeah, because people start quite young. Okay.
Was there maybe not enough chefs as well for...
Do you know what? Not really, no, because in Denmark and in Scandinavia, the cooking field is considered a really prestigious career to go down.
Okay.
So a lot of people, and also in Scandinavia, the work environment's better, the support that you have and is just better. So yeah, it's just not really seen as something, it's not seen as so much of a kind of a vocational kind of craft that it's seen as in other countries.
Yeah.
So yeah, and people really, they take it really seriously.
At what time do you decide to move from Copenhagen to London to make
the
big jump?
So I moved to Manchester first.
Manchester?
Yeah. So I had never lived in London, but moved to Manchester for an old partner. We met in Spain, funny enough, and he was living there and I was working as a sous chef in Copenhagen. And it was kind of that time where you're I'm ready for the next step, but I don't know what that is, where I'm at now.
Yeah.
I wasn't as confident as a cook as I am now. I'd never done my own thing. So I was just kind of looking for that next step and to learn something else and be in a new environment while I was still youngish.
Well, you're still a youngish.
It's funny because we keep on saying it. It's not the first podcast that we're saying that working in hospitality, you get to travel as you wish, really.
Yeah.
You can jump from one country to another.
Yeah.
And again, you're kind of demonstrating that, which is great.
And
that's what we kind of want to show quite a lot of people. It's such, hospitality can really get you everywhere and anywhere in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, food is the same everywhere. Cooking, your knife skills are going to be the same in any country. Your understanding of cooking is going to be the same. And, so it's something that you can take anywhere you want, really. And it's, I think as a cook as well, it's so exciting to get to discover new ingredients, new techniques, new cultures,
new cuisine.
Yeah. So I think that's what draws a lot of chefs to kind of go out and travel, is just that constant yearning for the next thing and for learning something new or working with something new.
Yeah. So when you arrive in Manchester, you're still gonna go for a Nordic kind of restaurant or something new?
Back then, I moved in 2019, and right now Manchester is a very kind of up and coming food city, but back then there was very few places to work. So I was very kind of torn because I came from this amazing food city where you had anything that you could possibly dream of in terms of, as a cook, places to work. But then I just looked online, I looked on Instagram, and I thought, okay, I'm just gonna look at some new openings and see what's coming up. And I found this place called Ørst, so the place I was in Copenhagen was the first place I'd ever worked that worked with natural wine. And I thought that was really cool, and I really fell in love with it. And then I heard of this place called Ørst that was opening up that had a focus on natural wine, small plates, which I had never done before. I'd mostly done kind of tasting menus, so that was new. And then it was kind of just going back to basics, cooking over coal, bigger cuts of meat on the grill, and just really simplistic cooking with, where you take seasonal produce and do very little to it. So that really interested me. And so I went over on just a weekend trip, flew over, it's an hour and a half flight. So headed over to meet with the head chef. They didn't have, the site was a building site. There was nowhere to, I'm the kind of person that will do at least one trial shift, before I even think about if it's the right place. And so for me, I was here I am moving to this new country. in this city that's so different. It's such a culture shock, and to work in a place that doesn't exist yet. And so with a type of cuisine I've never worked with before.
That's
so,
a big jump. Yeah, actually.
Yeah, it was a gamble for sure. Yeah. I mean, it could have gone anyway, but it was an amazing place. And I think I talk about this a lot, that it really became a stepping stone for what I'm doing now, because I'd never done that kind of like simplistic cooking. And so if I would have gone from that kind of Nordic kind of tweezer plated, you know, very kind of aesthetically driven Nordic food on a tasting menu to bistro food, I think that would have been quite a drastic jump for me, because what I do now is just take really kind of homely, classic, lovely bistro dishes and just make them really, you know, that just taste good, but they are really simple. So
that's really good.
Yeah. But you know, so Erst really taught me a lot about the simplicity of cooking and how to really champion that, and also just had a massive focus on wine, which I thought was really cool. So yeah, we opened there, and then COVID hit, and that was crazy. But right before COVID, it was a really, really slow opening, because Manchester at the time didn't really have an understanding of natural wine, or, you know, they didn't really have anything like that. So there was a lot of kind of misunderstanding or just lack of interest in that kind of food when we first opened.
So you were in Manchester during COVID?
Yeah.
Okay, because I lived in Manchester probably just before COVID.
Did you?
I did, yeah, 2019.
Okay, so we may have just been open then. Yeah, yeah.
What was the name of the restaurant?
Erst.
Erst.
E-R-S-T.
It's when you used to work at the Locotel.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah, I was only there for 6 months.
Okay, so it's a really lovely city. Yeah. I mean, it's especially now, like there's so many amazing places that have opened and... But yeah, I mean, at the time it was just there was a lot of kind of like pizza, burger, you know, like, you know, places like that. But there wasn't, you know, and then there was fine dining as well, you know, so there wasn't really anything in between. Mm. So yeah, it was a very slow start, you know. Yeah.
And now it's becoming, like you said, up and coming in terms of food.
Yeah, but then, you know, it was such an opposite experience to the experience of opening Bistro Freddy, because it was such a slow burn. But then we got a Jay Rayner review right before COVID, and that was, you know, really explosive for us. You know, he named it as one of his best meals of the year. He really loved the food, and, you know, that was the first time that, you know, it was a really big experience for us. And so that kind of made... it saved us for when we reopened, because all these people wanted to book in, because that happened right before it closed for COVID. So it kind of saved the restaurant in a sense. And and then we opened back up, and then it was just amazing. And we kept getting loads of national reviews. We, you know, made it on the Michelin guide, and it was just really, it took off from there. And then all these other incredible places opened, so it was almost like being kind of part of a movement, you know, in a city where nothing like that existed before. So it was an amazing experience.
That's really cool. And so after Manchester, London?
Yeah, so, you know, I was sous chef there, and so like any sous chef at some point in their career, they think, should I take the next step? Should I
the
run
chef.
My own should I run my own kitchen? Because you know, I'd always cooked someone else's food. And while I was there, I also started the Supper Club. So, you know, that was the first time I kind of got to be creative and do whatever I wanted to do and kind of experiment and not cook someone else's menu. So that's kind of when I decided, you know, I just kind of want to make that step and manage my own kitchen. So, and there just wasn't really anywhere that was, you know, any new openings or anything anywhere for me to take that step. So I started looking towards London, and because I loved the UK and I felt really at home here. And so I was put in touch with Dom Hamdi, who owns Bar Crispin and Crispin. Went to Bar Crispin and did kind of a guest chef dinner there with Fabian, the head chef, and just really loved the ethos of the company. And I really, you know, that's where I met Alex Price, who, you know, now does all of the wine lists across the company. And I just really enjoyed working with her. And And so when he told me that they were going to be opening a new restaurant where she would write the wines, I would do the menu, that was like a dream. So
it's a good pairing. Yeah, exactly.
yeah, it was. So yeah, and it was also just, it was really cool because, you know, obviously like as a woman, like I was used to working with all men my whole life, but then to have a female sommelier and then our general manager Sinead was a woman, and so to have, you know, an all female management team in a restaurant is something really rare.
This is
so
great.
Yeah, it was just a dream for me, and you know, I was so happy that my first head chef role would be running a restaurant with women. So
without complication of that kind of male presence.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was really cool.
So how was the first experience as a chef? A bit stressed at the beginning, or you're going very smoothly when you're doing the first menu?
I mean, so the menu we developed for quite a while, because when I moved to London, we were still looking for a site. So I moved to London without a site, without a start day, without an opening day. And then I think, you know, they viewed probably over 30 sites all over London.
And 30 sites.
But I mean, you're looking for the perfect place, you know, for a venue.
Yeah, but 30 is a lot. Huh?
I think they said it was 30. I think so. But I went to maybe a handful of the viewings, but they were like behind the scenes.
Oh, so you were recruited way before.
Yeah. Okay. I was still in Manchester.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I was still working as kind of like an acting sous chef. They had already hired my replacement, but our head chef, Pat, knew that I was waiting on this project. Mm-hmm. So he very kindly just kind of like let me stay on board until I was ready to move. But hired my replacement so that I could essentially go at any time.
Oh, this is nice.
Very
convenient.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we had a really great working relationship, and so he obviously supported me in this next move. And so, that kind of allowed me the freedom of, also I just kind of was able to take a step back and just kind of, I was essentially just kind of a cook, you know, a chef de partie, which was also really nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then we finally, while we were waiting to find a site, we finally came across the site that we found. Yeah. And yeah, it just ticked all the boxes. And I went when it was still before we kind of took over, and I remember looking around and thinking like, this is absolutely perfect, this is everything that we want, and I could just see it there. And I think you just, you know, like when you're looking for a house or anything else, you just kind of get that feeling where like, this is it, you know,
this is home.
The place is great. It's just in front of Le Roi.
It's
perfect in the middle of Shoreditch.
It's a great location. It really is, and it's such a unique shape, but it feels very cozy. And we're in the daytime, it's flooded with sunlight, and it's just such a beautiful place. But, you know, but then we brought Jermaine Gallagher in, who did the design, and Dom did. And he just did such an amazing job in making it kind of, because he designed Bar Crispin as well.
Oh, okay,
Soho.
With the little candles.
Exactly. And so he has such a unique style. And so, you know, to see that translated into a French bistro was really cool, and I think he just nailed it. It's stunning.
It's great. No, it's great. That's what I was telling, like, before we started the podcast, the ambiance, the cuisine, the wine list. It's a really good restaurant.
so now you find a location as a head chef. What do you do that, you know, now you've got the keys of the shop?
Yeah.
What's your mission? Obviously creating the menu, recruiting your staff.
Yeah.
So what has been the biggest challenge in an opening?
Gosh, I mean, it all happened pretty smoothly. I mean, the first person that we recruited was the sous chef. And to me, that was the most important thing, because having been through the opening of Erst as sous chef, I knew that there was so many things that pulls the head chef out of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So you need someone really solid to kind of be able to command the kitchen and run the kitchen and be able to do everything that, you know, that's kind of needing doing while you step away. And it's such an important relationship between the head chef and sous chef, because it's, you know, your right hand person. It's the person that's there being you when you're not there. And it's, in a lot of ways, I mean, it's a really hard role, because you do pretty much everything the head chef does, but you don't get any of the credit.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're also the kind of the ears and the eyes of the head chef. You're the person that's still in the trenches with the other chefs. Like, when the head chef's there, you're working the line like the other chefs. And so it's a very kind of complicated, it's probably the most complicated role in a kitchen, because you have to be able to be a leader and the head chef when they're not there, but also have a enough like lack of ego to also just be able to hop on a section and be a chef. So it, for me, that was the most important role. And we interviewed a few people and we found some really great candidates. But in my mind, I always thought of my friend Frankie, who is now my senior sous chef, because he's an old friend of mine. He was junior sous at Erst. And he, I knew that he was thinking about London because he took some time off. He left Erst. He went to Jamaica because he discovered he had some family there, or he was put in touch with some family, and he went to go kind of rekindle those relationships and meet those people and spend some time and learn about his heritage. And so I just said, fuck it, I'm just going to call him up one day and just see, do you want to do this thing with me? And so I called him up, and we laugh about it now because it was like a random number from London, because he was had a different phone while he was in Jamaica, and he was like walking on the beach one day and he just gets this phone call from me, the last person he expected yeah. to get a call from when he's walking around the beach in Jamaica. And I'm just like, hey Frankie, how's it going? Do you think you're going to be moving to London? And if not, do you want to and come be my sous chef? And he was like, okay, this is not what I expected you to call me and say, but give me a couple of days and I'll think about it. And then he just messaged me. He was like, yeah, let's do it. And so he came on board as the first person on the team, and he and I kind of developed the opening menu together. So that was a crazy experience because we didn't have a kitchen yet. So we were developing the menu and testing the dishes in my home kitchen. So he would like come over for shifts okay. in my flat. And, you know, we would just try out different recipes, and it was like the heat of summer, and I don't have any windows in the downstairs of my flat. So it was like this stuffy with this sauna. Horrible. Yeah, it was like a sauna. There was like, my extraction is horrible. And so we're just in this like little London kitchen flat, and just trying out, like there was like at one point we did a pop-up in Margate at our friend Natalia's wine bar set. Okay. And so we did all the prep in my kitchen. So we had like 5 different pots of sauces reducing, and there was like condensation on the wall, and my cat was running around, and it was like, it was the most hectic, insane experience. And then our director would come over and try these different things we were trying. And, you know, some of it was like, absolutely. And some of it was like, hell no. It was just, it was this really fun, crazy experimental time where we were just kind of like figuring it out, like scribbling down recipes. Cause yeah, we were just in my house, you know? Yeah. But yeah, that's where we developed a lot of our kind of things that are still on the menu now. So yeah.
Sounds like a great experience.
Sounds like a good experience.
It's a bit yeah. like, I would say it's like all the tech companies, they do it in the yeah. garage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I like this behind the scenes. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure like people who don't work in hospitality or are not chef, or they don't know about all of this, they always imagine like, oh, they're doing like the prep in a nice fancy kitchen like a few weeks before.
Yeah.
Well, actually, no. Yeah. Not every time.
And it's nice to have that view of, you know, behind the scenes, and yeah. it's not yeah. like, never really how you imagine it, really. It's
yeah.
And I'm sure chefs, you know, like you said, sometimes you have those nights where you kind of invite yourselves and you're just like, let's try something new, and mm-hmm. a bottle of wine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And let's go for it, and then you discover stuff. Yeah. Nice little story to it.
Yeah.
How did it go with finding customers? Because obviously it's new opening. You had the bar, I think, was open before, Bar Crispin.
Yeah, so Bar Crispin, well, Crispin was, I think, the original.
Yeah, okay.
Which was kind of like a residency space, yeah. and then later became a restaurant, okay. and then Bar Crispin. And they, I think they all, I mean, Dom has told me so many times that, like, they had a very, very different experience with each site. Having learned the lessons that he learned from those yeah. openings, I think he just had a very, very clear vision of what he wanted this yeah. to be.
So you had a customer base already that you could
yeah
you know, bring
I mean
in.
It was a big press launch, you know.
Oh, there was okay
yeah
we that worked, helps doesn't it
yeah yeah mm. So we worked with a PR company, Super Duper Comms. Mm. They're amazing, and they went so above and beyond our launch, and it was a really, really amazing launch. Like, it was so above and beyond my expectations. But of course, with Crispin and Bar Crispin already being known, you know, it kind of like was like, this is the next chapter for that company, for that group. But yeah, it was really nerve-wracking. I remember the day that the press release rolled out, and it was like me, Dom, our ops manager, and Alex Price, and I, and we were just like, oh my God, this is so crazy. Like, people know now and they know where it is and they know the name of it. And, you know, it's like, it's we felt very vulnerable, you know, in that
moment.
Yeah,
but I mean, it's always like that at the beginning.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah. Nothing goes to plan at first.
No, no.
You know, the whole PR thing going in, and I guess you've seen the difference over the first month. It must have been like, you know, rammed of people and then continuous in that sense. And
yeah, it was crazy because they were still, I mean, I remember they were painting the bathroom still like on opening night, and they were like, I got locked into the bathroom because the lock was faulty for 30 minutes. And they had construction workers like trying to get me out, and I had like 1,000 things on the stove, and like, it was crazy. I mean, all openings are crazy.
No
way.
So you're locked into
an hour. Yeah, and I was ran out into the kitchen. I was like, oh my God, guys, I'm so sorry. And they're like, oh, were you gone? I didn't even know. There. Everyone was so focused on what they were doing.
That's how you know you got a good team.
Yeah,
but I do. I mean, I've been so lucky with the team that I've had since opening. We've had an amazing team. You know, we've had a few people leave, a few people come, you know, I mean, but we've always, we've been able to retain, you know, our staff in the kitchen,
For the most part.
And you know, they're all super passionate about what they do. You know, there's no one that's just kind of like whatever about it. They're really passionate. They love what they do. So I'm really, really lucky to have them.
So that's the present, now the future.
Yeah. Yes.
What's holding for you?
Yeah. So when I leave, I'm leaving in August, and I'm just going to be creative for a while. I'm going to do some pop-ups, and I'm just kind of trying to figure out what the next step for me is. And I think, like, you know, every chef, I think, that's been at a restaurant for a little bit, you always kind of know in your gut when it's time.
Okay.
And, you know, I think that feeling just came for me sooner than I thought, but I think I just want to figure out like what I want to do in terms of cooking, because I've always cooked someone else's concept. I've always cooked what someone else told me to cook, you know. The only time I've ever really been like fully creative with full creative freedom is in my supper club. So
speak to us about your supper club actually.
I love talking about it. It's definitely my biggest passion. It's called Supper, and it's a charity supper club that supports women's charities. And I started it with our sommelier at Kim McBride, and she is so incredibly knowledgeable about wine, and she's so passionate about it, but she's also a very down-to-earth, like, lovely, easygoing person. So she made it very approachable and accessible, and she has a way of talking about wine that makes you just kind of understand. That's not, you know, she's so like unpretentious.
She lives in London?
She lives in Manchester.
Oh, she lives in Manchester.
Yeah. Okay. So she was our somm at Erst to start, and then she left hospitality to do support work. So she works. Yeah. So that's kind of what made us want to do it. So she was volunteering for a women's charity in Manchester called Trafford Rape Crisis, and they do amazing work. They're a local charity, and we were just talking one day about how underfunded a lot of these charities are, and she was like, you know, we talked about doing a like one-off kind of charity dinner where we could help raise some funds, and then we did two, and then all of a sudden, like completely unexpectedly, all these women in hospitality, like both somms or front of house or chefs, they all got in touch, and they're like, oh my God, do you want to do another one? I'd love to do one with you. And then more and more people got in touch. So it was really because of other women wanting to get involved that it became a supper club. And and then we did multiple, I mean, I can't even remember how many we've done so far. We've been involved in lots of different campaigns and lots of different, you know, it's just been amazing, really, like the outpour of support for these. Yeah. I mean, all of our suppliers back in Manchester would be you know, absolutely, I'll donate this to you. Like, we had this amazing butcher, Little Woods Butcher, who was an independent kind of run company. And he, every time I ordered through the restaurant for the supper clubs, he was like free of charge. You know, so it's amazing. Nice. Yeah, it's amazing, you know, how supportive people have been to the charities we work with. And we work with a lot of charities that deal with things like domestic abuse or women who are coming over as refugees. And so it's just really nice to see how supportive people have been of that. And then we did our first one in London with Alex Price, actually, at Crispin, and a lovely chef named Amber Francis, who used to be the head chef at Maine. And we did one in London, and we were like, oh my God, I don't even know if tickets are going to sell. Like, this is, no one knows what this is. And we sold out, like, almost immediately. And people keep getting in touch asking for the next one. So,
how many spaces?
It depends on the space that we do it in. So we've done anywhere between 20 to 45, just really
That's
depends
really
on,
cool.
yeah, it just depends on the restaurant space really and their capacity. But yeah, it's incredible. And
so how it works is basically you kind of create this supper club, which is a dinner in a restaurant, which changes every so often.
It depends on who we collaborate with. Okay. So we tend to collaborate with the women of a different restaurant. So yeah, and then we do like usually a tasting menu, and then we do all the wine pairings using either women run suppliers or women winemakers. And so everyone behind the supper clubs are women.
Yeah.
So yeah, the somms, the winemakers, the you know, everyone is a woman.
What about the customers? Only
women? No, it's all inclusive. It's all inclusive. So a lot of men come to them as well, which is really cool.
Yeah, that's really nice.
Very supportive. Yeah.
So every ticket that you sell, obviously, it goes straight to the charity.
Yeah. So all the profit we make is all for the charity.
Oh, well done.
So yeah, it's really, and it's so rewarding to be able to,
I can imagine,
you know, when we give the donation to them. And we tend to try to support local charities where our donations can go make the most difference to them, because a lot of the bigger national charities receive more funding, of course. So
how often do you do them?
So back in Manchester, we did them quite regularly. Okay. But so now we last year just became approved as a CIC, which is a community interest company. So we now have myself and Kim, who are the co-founding directors. And then we have two new directors, who one is this incredible chef, Anna Carmichael, who is based in Liverpool. So Kim and her do the northern events up north. And then Sinead, who is our general manager at Bistro Freddy, she has come on board as a director. So she and I will be doing all of the London-based events. So,
That's so cool.
Yeah. And then she's now doing a residency with her partner in Aix-de-Provence in France. And so we are next month going to be hosting our first international supper in France. And we're super excited to be working with women outside of the UK.
Yeah. Amazing project.
Yeah.
We will put in the description all the link to your super club and the charity,
Definitely, of course. Yeah. And so obviously you did it in the UK, but how did it come about to do it in France?
Yeah.
How
so, well, Kim was actually a couple years ago contacted by some women in France, in Lyon, who wanted to get in touch. And then there was also a gallery space in Paris who had kind of heard about it and got in touch. And then it never really happened because we opened Bistro Freddy and then I was so busy. But then now that Sinead's there doing her residency, and she's doing all the wines for the residency that she and her partner do. So she has now gotten to know a lot of winemakers and a lot of women in the industry, and has just, you know, she's so great at kind of like advocating for it and getting, you know, networking. So yeah, we just thought, of course, we should do one there.
And have you been contacted by other women in other countries?
No, not yet. Not yet. But we would love to do any. Yeah.
I'd love
to do one in Denmark. I really would. I'd love to do one in Copenhagen. So that might be the next one. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, we still need to start doing them in London again, because we've both been very busy with the restaurant opening. So
it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
That's the supper club. So what is your ideal scenario for what's next, apart from obviously the supper club, which is going really well? What's your ideal?
I'd love to have another opening or another project in whatever way. I think I'm just needing some time to kind of be creative and just kind of figure out what that next step should be. And I think that's a really free kind of time in my career, because I've never left a job for, you know, without leaving it for another job. So I'm just very excited to just kind of discover what kind of food I would like to be cooking, and And whether that's a new concept that I come up with, or whether that's a new opening, or whether that's, yeah, I'm pretty much just open to anything. But I think, you know, I went back to Copenhagen recently and I saw my old head chef from back when I was apprentice. And he said, he gave me such good advice where he just said, look, just fuck around and be creative for a while. You've just done this insane opening. It's been so exhausting, wonderful, but exhausting. So just be creative. And that's something I never even thought was like an option. But so many of my friends in the industry have gone down that route. I think especially because of, you know, you have all these stress factors in terms of staffing and your daily stresses of when the sink breaks or the stove breaks. Yeah. So being able to just go around and just be creative is such a liberating idea. It's terrifying, but it also just, it's great that we live in a time when that's kind of become a thing. And London is such an amazing place to do it because there's so many spaces and so many wonderful people to collaborate with. And so, yeah, I'm just gonna kind of see where that takes me. And then when the right project comes about, I'm sure I'll know when it's right.
Nice. Yeah. Do you have any maybe project of opening your own restaurant one day, which is not part of the future at all?
I mean, I, of course, like, you know, I think everyone thinks like that's your end game as a chef. But at the same time, I also am a cook. I'm not a business owner. And I set out to cook because that's what I love to do. So I don't think I would ever open a restaurant without, you know, with my own money. I think that I would love to be involved in a project where I had more ownership over it. But I think the end game would probably be to start something with my partner, who's also a chef, because...
Oh, wow. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Chef couples, that's nice.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, he's, you know, he's a brilliant chef. And, you know, I knew about him for a long time before we even met. I've always followed his career. He's amazing. He earned his first Michelin star before he was 30. Like, he's an incredibly talented person.
Where does he work?
So he and I met up north, actually, but he's from down here.
Okay.
And he was the head chef at a place called The Barn at Morehall, which is in Lancashire. Then when I found out I was coming to London, well, when I met him, I had a plan to move to London, but then I took this project on and then he decided to move with me. And so he's just taken over a place in West London in Chiswick called The Silver Birch. And he's doing incredible food. It's, you know, he's doing really elevated kind of British cooking. He's one of the most talented people I've ever met.
What's his name?
His name's Nathan Cornwell.
Nathan, if you want to come to the podcast,
you're next.
He would, I'm sure he would.
Yeah. Oh, pressure.
But yeah, I mean, he's just, I think he's the type of chef that you just, I feel like he's like the last of a certain generation of chefs. Like, he left home when he was like 16 years old to go work in a Michelin kitchen and has only ever worked in kind of fine dining. So he's just from that generation of chefs that just worked from the time they were young and knows nothing else. And he's so incredibly passionate about what he does, and he lives and breathes it. And so I'm just in awe of him every time I eat his food. But he's someone that back in the day I would have loved to have learned from.
If you have kids one day,
oh my, very lucky kids. Gonna be a cook as well.
Yeah, but it's funny because he grew up in such a different environment to me. Like, I grew up in kind of like city apartments, and he grew up in the countryside, growing their own vegetables, being so like fishing, shooting pigeons. So he's always been very like attached to the nature. Ingredients that he and the ingredients that he cooks with. So whereas like I grew up, you know, with two working parents that, you know, made maybe some like frozen lasagna for dinner when they came home, you know what I mean? So we had two completely different childhoods in terms of food. And he also worked in Copenhagen.
I feel like there's a lot of people part of the hospitality who have been to Copenhagen at least one time for their career, as a can be sommelier or can be cook.
Yeah.
It's a real capital of the food scene.
Yeah. It's a good place to learn for sure. And I think like, you know, the excitement of learning from this kind of new wave of Nordic chefs that have essentially taken, because Danish traditional food is very similar to like English pub food. It's like, you know, meat and potatoes, like very stodgy, you know, nothing
basic.
Fancy, basic, delicious, just like, you know, classic British pub food is of course delicious, but you know, but Nordic food is kind of saying, let's go back to our roots and just create, learn from how people used to do it.
Preserve food, depending
so
on the weather and seasons. Exactly.
Yeah. And so I think that's what has attracted a lot of chefs and cooks to that place, is that that's just a really interesting mindset to learn from.
When you think about it, like all cities, such as London, New York, Paris, you name it, we've got everything available to us. Everything is imported.
Of course, in London, we can have all the product we want, but it's also like the price you're going to pay for it as well. Mm. Especially when you're a cook, when you see now the prices for the chocolate, for the vegetables, for the butter. Yeah.
It's ridiculous, but I mean, you know, that's how it is. I've got a little question for you. So if you had four ingredients to choose from to cook something, what would they be?
Butter. Yeah. 100% butter.
Oh, we can see you working in a French bistro. Butter and cream.
I would say more butter. Butter, good olive oil, vinegar, probably. God, that's so hard.
And again, I didn't even say like what kind of meal would you do with four ingredients, so imagine.
Yeah, I would say probably butter, olive oil, lemon. Lemon is in everything.
Lemon and vinegar,
And salt, of course. Salt, lemon, like butter, olive oil. Yeah.
It's a nice blend of the French and the Nordic cuisine. It's really cool. I have another question then. One last meal as a chef, what will be?
Honestly, fish and chips.
Fish and chips?
I love fish and chips. It's like my favorite. It's the first thing I ever ate when I was a child coming to England. I remember loving it then. And that's what my favorite dish on the menu right now at Bistro Freddy is our fried skate with curry sauce.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was like an ode to fish and chips. We had to have it on the menu, absolutely. Some sort of iteration of it,
And where's the best fish and chips to have in London?
My friend Darren recently introduced me to this place in, where is it? Is Lamb's Conduit, I think it is. It's called The Friar's Delight, and it's amazing. Okay. It's really, really good. But
they are specialized in fish and chips.
It's a fish and chip shop. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But, you know, I've rarely had a bad fish and chips. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like amazing fish and chips in Margate. But anywhere I go on a British coast that has a chip shop, like, I will go there and eat. Like, it's incredible. It's really incredible.
They do have some great one in Brighton.
Yes, I can imagine.
I was in Brighton recently. Yeah. Well, you can eat it in front of the sea, so obviously it's always better.
For me, about fish, I can't eat fish in London because I'm not next to the sea.
Yeah.
And I can only eat fish when I'm by the sea. It's really weird. Any restaurant, it can be the best restaurant, and they have fish on the menu, I never go for it.
You're never eating fish?
No.
Oh, really?
I need to be by the sea to eat fish. And I love fish, but I just need to be in the mood.
But also, like, we're on an island.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, so. I can't see I need to see the water.
You need to smell the sea air.
Yeah, I need at least during the day to have that, oh, yeah, I've been next to the water. Yeah. Makes sense.
I mean, we get incredible fish from, you know, like, all over the islands.
Yeah.
And I truly think British fish is incredible. Yeah. I mean, you get such incredible, like the Cornish fish, the Scottish fish. It's
no,
so,
the fish
so
is
wonderful.
Also the meat that we have in the UK is incredible.
Yeah.
If you get it sourced properly, they have one of the best meats in the whole world, actually.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Anna.
Thank you so much.
The end.
Thank you.
The 50 minutes already. Thank you very much again. It was really nice to have you. Maybe if you have your last word, what kind of advice will you give to the young chef?
Always take notes when you go on stages, always, because you will not remember anything. And then it's so good to look back. I mean, staging was like the most learning experiences I did as a young cook. So always write things down.
Thank you very much. Anna.
Thank you.
And don't forget to follow her on Instagram, obviously.
Yeah.
Just Anna Sogard.
There you go. And make sure you go and see her before she leaves.
Bistro Freddy. Yeah. You have until August.
Until end of August?
August 8th.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, wow. So just a week.
Yeah.
A month, sorry.
A month.
Yeah. Well, big week.
Just a month left. But thank you for listening, guys, again.
Thank you, guys.
And guys, don't forget to give us a review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. It really helps the channel. And we'll see you for the next episode.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. The Hospitality Podcast.